Markets overseas are still responding to the latest U.S. unemployment numbers. On Friday, the Labor Department reported that employers added 103,000 jobs in September. That's about double what economists had projected. Still, those gains weren't enough to change the unemployment rate, which is stuck at 9.1%. Most of the new jobs are coming from small businesses, and the decision to add even one person to the payroll is a huge leap of faith for a small company. NPR's Wendy Kaufman profiles a firm that's done the math and is ready to hire.
At the beginning of each week, Rusty George, the founder of a Tacoma, Washington image building and marketing company that bears his name, holds a staff meeting.
And this is our conference room right here.
George pulls down a very cool-looking, transparent garage door to close off the conference room. The door is a throwback to the time when this loft office was a garage. Now it houses 8 employees, a number that will soon grow to 9.
All right, guys, welcome to our meeting today. Happy Monday. So the first thing about the status meeting is we are looking for a new account manager. We've gotten about 3 to 5 resumes in of good qualified people. We're waiting on a couple of more, hopefully, to come in. Then we're going to start the hiring process.
The process, he tells them, will be careful and deliberate. Rusty George and his wife, Keturah George, the firm's operations manager, have learned a painful lesson.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, you just can't do things just based off of gut feeling.
In the middle part of the last decade, their business was booming and they hired like crazy. Rusty George says he didn't spend enough time asking himself, does this hire make economic sense? It certainly didn't appear that way when the economy collapsed and the law firms, condo developers, museums, solo entrepreneurs, and other clients stopped buying their services.
They just all turned their faucets off at the exact same time. And here we were riding with 17 people and a lot of people that were sitting around not really with anything that they could be working on that was billable.
George, who a few years back was named one of the state's best small business owners, would eventually lay off more than half the staff. He soon discovered that although he was bringing in less money, he was actually posting bigger profits. But over the past year or so, business has picked up substantially. Old clients are coming back, new ones are signing up, and Keturah George says the firm now has more work than it can handle.
And we're basically at that point where we don't feel like it would be fair to clients or our employees to not bring on somebody and you know, grow.
You guys having these discussions over dinner, over morning coffee, going, should we hire someone?
Driving to work and driving home from work. And
working
sitting
on Sunday. Yeah. Okay, well,
it's,
I think we're at
outside
the point that we can actually bring more people on.
But they made that decision only after doing the math. Using a variety of spreadsheets and other tools, they calculated the cost of a new employee practically to the penny.
Their medical and dental and their compensation, their parking, their computer, the amount of coffee that we'll have to, you know, start increasing. And then we put that into our major overhead and figure out how much more per hour it's going to cost us.
Then they figured out how much more revenue and profit could be generated by hiring the right person for a particular job. And only after those numbers added up did they post the job opening. Economist Ken Goldstein of the Conference Board says, for any company, the decision to hire is a big deal. But for a giant company, hiring an additional employee probably won't make much difference to the bottom line. But Goldstein says,
if you've got 8 employees and you add a 9th one and you made a monumental mistake, obviously, it's a much bigger chunk of your overall activity. So it's a bigger deal for a small company to get it right.
Rusty and Keturah George understand that.
As an employer and owning a business and running it, I always say failure's not an option. You just got to figure out, it may not be the same groove you were working in 4 years ago, but figuring out how that works for you now.
The Georges hope their new hire will be a great addition to their staff. They are still accepting resumes, but only the super qualified need apply. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We're going to spend some time now with America's largest minority, Latinos. Their numbers jumped in the last census and are growing fast. Sociologist Ruben Rumbaut has been studying thousands of children of immigrants since the 1990s.
The population growth of Hispanics has been stunning. That population was estimated to be about 4 million in 1950. It is over 50 million today, and it is about 16% or so of the total U.S. population, but it is expected to reach 25% of the total U.S. population in less than two decades.
So the growth remains huge. Now, these days, most of that growth comes not from immigration, but from Hispanics born in the United States. And these young Latinos are growing up immersed in two worlds.
To be bicultural, to be bilingual, means to feel comfortable in two cultural worlds, to feel comfortable and proficient in two languages, to be able to dance salsa, to be able to enjoy TV programs, movies, songs on the radio, and so on, that touch on many different genres. The U.S. American culture is a multi-layer construction made up of the contributions of many people over many, many decades. So the Hispanic or Latino contribution will be one more that will be layered upon that.
This morning, we begin a series called Two Languages, Many Voices, about bicultural Latinos and their impact on education, entertainment, religion, technology, and the workplace. We begin in a small town in Iowa called West Liberty.
Iowa's Hispanic population has almost doubled in the last decade. Latinos still make up only 5% of the state, but West Liberty is the first Iowa city with a Hispanic majority. NPR's David Shaper reports.
Downtown West Liberty, Iowa is quintessentially Midwestern American. It's both quaint and historic, with reddish brick buildings lining brick-paved streets.
What we're coming up to is 3rd Street. It's
walking past the bank, the renovated theater, a hair salon, restaurants, and shops, Mayor Chad Thomas says West Liberty is thriving. And he says about half of the businesses downtown are Hispanic-owned.
If you didn't have the Hispanic population here in town, yeah, there we would be much more like a lot of the smaller towns, and there would be a lot more storefronts that were empty. And
next to Paul Revere's Pizza on 3rd Street in West Liberty is Tienda La Luna. Next to the American Legion Hall is the popular Acapulco Mexican Bakery, among others. And many of these Hispanic businesses are not new. Mayor Thomas says this growing eastern Iowa town of 3,700 has had a significant Hispanic population for decades.
I mean, we're very unique in that, you know, there's folks in this community, in the Hispanic community, they're here on their fifth, sixth generation.
52% of West Liberty residents identified themselves as Hispanic or Latino in the 2010 census, up from just over 40% in 2000. The first surge in Latino immigrants arrived in the 1930s to fill jobs in what was then a Lewis Rich turkey processing plant. That plant, now West Liberty Foods, is still a draw for immigrants. But the bulk of the recent increase in the Hispanic population in West Liberty is in the growing established families. Many of the recent newcomers to West Liberty are those like Mayor Thomas, who moved here with his wife 11 years ago, seeking a quiet, friendly, small town and diversity.
A big factor for us, since we were thinking about kids, was the dual language school program. The thought of our children being able to go through the school system and come out speaking Spanish relatively fluently.
¿Todos escribieron 100,000?
Sí. Muy bien.
The dual language program in West Liberty schools was the first of its kind in the state. These fourth graders learn all of their subjects in both Spanish and English. West Liberty Elementary Principal Nancy Gardner says the program is voluntary, with half of the spots reserved for kids who speak English primarily at home, half for those who speak Spanish.
And in the end, all the students then become bilingual, biliterate, and bicultural.
The dual language program is now in its 14th year and is so successful it has a waiting list and is now a model for other Iowa school districts. Parent Martha Rodriguez says the program helps the younger generation hold on to their culture while giving them a competitive advantage. In addition, Rodriguez says her kids are able to build cross-cultural friendship.
My kids have always been doing good with either both Anglo and Hispanic kids, to hang around with both.
Was it that way when you were young?
No. It was completely different when I was young.
The 42-year-old Rodriguez immigrated to West Liberty from Mexico when she was 10. And she says back then, she and other Hispanics felt more isolated and segregated in West Liberty, especially those who didn't speak English well. But Rodriguez and others say those tensions, for the most part, are history.
We don't have the conflicts we used to have in the past.
Jose Zacarias moved to West Liberty from Mexico in 1984 and took a job in the turkey processing plant. As soon as he learned enough English, he found work elsewhere. But he sunk his roots in this close-knit small town, saved his money, and 20 years ago bought this old farmhouse on a couple of acres on the outskirts of town.
As you can see, this is a very quiet place and nice. Before they built the school, that was about 8 years ago, this was heaven.
Zacarias raised three boys here. Two are off at college, the third working full-time. And if that's how you measure success, he says, he's done okay. Like others here, Zacarias says at a time when Hispanics elsewhere around the country face an anti-immigrant backlash, it's refreshing that the small town of West Liberty is clearly trying to embrace and celebrate its diversity. David Shaper, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. A new jobs report today offers a glimmer of hope for the struggling economy. The Department of Labor says employers added 103,000 new jobs in September. That was enough to beat economists' forecasts, but it wasn't enough to change the unemployment rate. For the third month in a row, the jobless number is stuck at 9.1%. NPR's Sonari Glinton explains that businesses, especially small ones, are still cautious about hiring.
Phew. That's pretty much the sentiment of economists who wait for the unemployment numbers to come out each month.
Well, I think our initial response is a huge sigh of relief.
That's how Mark Vittner felt. He's senior economist at Wells Fargo.
There's been a lot of concern that maybe the economy was going to slide back into a second recession, and this should take some of those fears out.
The sectors that gained were construction, healthcare, and retail. The numbers were also helped by 45,000 Verizon workers who went back on the job after a strike. Meanwhile, manufacturing took a dip for the second month in a row. Vittner says, though, this is no time for a party.
There is little sign that conditions are improving for the long-term unemployed. The average duration of unemployment rose to 40.5 weeks. And when I look at that number and I think back over my lifetime, I never thought I would see a number that high.
Also today, PNC Financial Services released a survey that says 4 out of 5 small businesses will reduce or maintain their number of full-time employees over the next 6 months. Kim and Scott's Gourmet Pretzels has about 70 employees on Chicago's Near West Side. Kim Holstein is the CEO of the company. Her husband, Scott, is the president. Kim Holstein shows me the pretzel line.
Well, right now what we've done is these are our fully baked pretzels, and they're actually putting them on the line to pack them into 2-packs, and we put them into our boxes to send over to grocery stores in the frozen aisle.
Their pretzels can be found all over the country. Kim Holstein says as winter approaches, her business picks up. She's going to be hiring, but in a normal year, they may have added 20 workers. This winter, it'll be more like 10.
We have to be smart and careful. We have to make, you know, smart decisions where we're really conscious of, you know, do we have the business to hire these people? We don't want to hire a bunch of people and then lay them off.
Holstein's husband, Scott, says they've had to get creative.
What we've done, there are 3 senior positions that in the last year or 6 months, we switched from salaried employees full-time over to consultants. So the same person who was working full-time is now a consultant for us working part-time.
So what would make the Holsteins add more workers?
Demand really drives the hiring. So if we're just going to get a discount in, say, employment taxes, that's not necessarily an incentive. I mean, it's a little bit, it's nice, but it's not going to make us hire somebody. What makes us hire somebody is demand, you know, is needing to make more product.
Sean Harrington owns 2 bars in downtown Detroit. They're in about the best location for bars in Detroit, especially now. They're throwing distance from the stadium where the Tigers will play for baseball's American League Championship and the other stadium where football's Lions are undefeated. Harrington says things are good, but
in the businesses that we have right now, we're not adding anybody. We're just, if we lose somebody, we pick somebody else up. We're holding steady.
Harrington is 43. He's owned bars and restaurants in Detroit for almost 20 years. He says he's learned a pretty important lesson in these last few years. Stay lean.
If all of a sudden the cloud lifted on the economy and the European economy, the Greeks got their acts together and all the economies got better all over, I don't know if I would do things that much differently.
Harrington says he'll have to see a lot of customers in the seats for a long time before he goes on a hiring spree. Sonari Glenton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. The so-called Occupy Wall Street movement is in its third week of protests, a block from the nation's financial center in New York. The daily demonstrations carry echoes of a century ago and the decades leading up to the Great Depression. It was a time when protests were a regular feature on Wall Street and powerful financiers like J.P. Morgan were pilloried in song.
My name is Morgan, but it ain't J.P. There's no bank in Wall Street that belongs to me.
This was a popular tune in 1906 called My Name is Morgan, but it ain't J.P. For more now, I'm joined by Beverly Gage. She's an associate professor of history at Yale and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, the story of America in its first age of terror. Beverly Gage, welcome.
Thanks, Guy.
When did Wall Street become a place where protesters gathered?
Wall Street really began to consolidate its power as the center of American finance in the years around the Civil War. And then almost immediately after that, it became a target for protesters, really from a variety of places on the political spectrum. But throughout the late 19th century into the early 20th century, you had very regular demonstrations on Wall Street. And as you were suggesting, figures like J.P. Morgan were loved in some circles, but were mostly hated by many segments of the American people and who spent a great deal of time talking about and criticizing Wall Street.
Let's talk about the period sort of before and after the First World War. Who were the kinds of people who were going out to demonstrate on Wall Street?
Well, I think the first movement that really coalesced around a kind of anti-Wall Street message was the populist movement, which came of age in the late 19th century. And then by the early 20th century, you have a wave of different movements taking off. You have the rise of the Socialist Party in the United States, for whom Wall Street was the great symbol of American corruption and greed. And you had the labor movement. And then you also have even more radical movements to the left, anarchists, communists. But so you have a huge range of people from different positions in American society with different messages, but all really going after Wall Street itself.
Much of the movement really culminates in a devastating terror attack in 1920, targeting J.P. Morgan. What happened?
Right. That occurred on September 16th, 1920, which was a pretty ordinary Thursday afternoon, and a horse-drawn cart exploded at the corner of Wall and Broad Streets. So right directly next to the Morgan Bank, very close to the New York Stock Exchange, it ended up killing 38 people and wounding several hundred. And it was by far the most sort of dramatic symbol of this confrontation that had been building for decades.
The protesters today are mounting nonviolent protests, but what sorts of parallels do you see between those movements back then and what we are seeing today?
Well, I think, right, on the question of violence, that was a very different world in the teens and 20s. And so I don't think that those kinds of comparisons have much to do with the protesters today. But what I do think they're drawing on historically is that movements against Wall Street have always been these very multifarious movements. You've had lots of different sorts of people involved, and they haven't always necessarily gotten together around one single piece of legislation. But nonetheless, they've been visible. They've pressed questions about inequality, about the role of Wall Street and finance in the American economy, and just big moral questions about what do we want out of our society. And I think those are really the themes that you're seeing coming out of the Wall Street protests today.
Are there clear parallels, in your view, between the economic circumstances of those times and what we're seeing today?
Well, I think it's really remarkable when you look at the span of the 20th century. We're really seeing ourselves at the dawn of the 21st century in a lot of similar conditions to what we would have seen 100 years ago. In terms of inequality, we have the same kinds of stratifications of wealth that we would have seen 100 years ago and that actually shrank in the middle of the century but have since widened back out. In terms of labor organizing, we have very similar numbers. At their peak in the middle of the 20th century, labor unions recognized or organized about 35% of the private sector workforce. At the turn of the 20th century and now back at the turn of the 21st century, those numbers are back down around 7 or 8%. So I think in terms of economic inequality, in terms of labor organizing, you actually see very, very similar dynamics now.
Why did the protest movement on Wall Street go away?
Right. Well, I think that in the 1920s, Wall Street had a kind of banner decade. But when we hit the Great Depression in 1929, you actually saw earlier critiques come surging back. And one of the things that's really remarkable about the New Deal is that you see a whole rash of legislation intended to address the kinds of issues that had been talked about and that Wall Street had been the symbol of for decades. So I think in part the ferocity of the criticism of Wall Street went away because you had some sort of amelioration of reforms in the New Deal. And so that earlier politics that was really centered around those issues became more muted as the century went on.
I've been speaking with Beverly Gage about the history of Wall Street protests. She's an associate history professor at Yale University and author of the book The Day Wall Street Exploded. Beverly Gage, thanks.
Thanks, Guy.